The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is unfortunately the second time in the last couple of months we're going back to the Hardball podcast archives because one of the biggest presences in MLB history, along with more importantly one of the most beloved players in the game's history, has passed. I'll play the entire episode, introduction and all, but I wanted to just add a few things to the beginning and end of this episode. Frank Howard was one of a couple of handful of men that I would just call to say hello to. Jim Bouton, Ralph Branca, Eldon Auker, Bobby Thompson, Tracy Stallard, Whitey Ford. I still do it with Carl Erskine, Bobby Richardson, Rocky Colavito. What happened 2 years ago, when Frank was 85, I called and after telling me he was doing okay, he asked me about me and how I was doing. We joked that I was as okay as a man with, at the time, 18 and 16-year-old daughters could be doing. I reminded him about the sneaking smoke incident in that shed in West Palm Beach, and he told me he would not verify it, but he knew, and I quote, there was a good chance it happened, with a laugh. I never intended to start a conversation that would lead to what you were about to hear. This is a man in a place on a given day that offered me a chance to come on in, into his home, his mind, and his memories. No prepared questions, thank God, no agenda, just a baseball life where I had the time to, without either of us knowing at the time, spend one more hour talking about the game, its history, and doing what Frank Howard did as well as anyone I've ever spoken to. Talk about other players, not himself, never himself. What I've been told by a few people, including one of his nephews, this was probably the last real sit-down he did. And boy, was it worth it. To put it in the top 10, people I've spoken to, conversations I've had that seem important in the sense that it's baseball's history, not just one man's story, he fits the bill. And that's all on Frank. Quick note, this is a man whose second chapter of his baseball life included coaching for 19 years. 19 years, wisdom, encouragement, experience. There's no telling how he might have shaped dozens of careers. Can't thank him enough for his baseball friendship. Please stick around for the very end of this episode. I've added something that maybe explains why Frank was great for the game. You'll hear he hit his last home run in Washington in 1971. We've got the call, and what he did for the fans that day is just amazing. He'll talk of Whitey Ford, Gil Hodges, Mickey Mantle, and Hank Aaron, because that's what he did. He played the game, and he loved the game, and he respected the game and its players. And we win because of that. Spring to summer to fall to winter. And then it all starts all over again with a baseball season. Frank Howard saw a lot of seasons in his 87 years, and we were lucky enough to at least have his thoughts on some of it.
Heroes get remembered.
Here's the windup.
Legends never die.
Fastball hit deep to right.
Welcome to Hardball.
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Major League Baseball's history in first person. Conversations that span almost 20 years.
It is 9:46 p.m.
With the men who saw and made that history.
Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch.
Many of whom are no longer with us.
Swung on and missed a perfect game.
Stories from the 1930s. To the 21st century. This is Hardball.
Dad, you want to have a catch?
Welcome into Hardball. My name is Chris Domino, and this is our continued trek through the history of baseball, one conversation at a time. If you're just finding us today, if the name of the gentleman who is joining me is the reason you click play, thanks for that. I hope you end up coming back in weeks to come and perhaps look at the list of previous episodes and find a few that might interest you enough to hit the subscribe button and listen. If you're coming back for this one after being a regular or making your way through some of the episodes when you can, thanks again. I hope at some point, if you enjoy what you're hearing, you might tell a few friends or family members who are interested in hearing both the baseball and social stories that these men lived through and now have an opportunity to tell through social media or just an old-fashioned text or phone call. And if you can, would appreciate if you can hit that subscribe button and perhaps rate and write a quick review if you listen on Apple or iTunes. It helps spread the word for reasons I don't understand, but I was told it would be smart to put forth the ask, so there it is. As some of you know, these are hopefully, when done right, just two men who have settled into a couple of comfortable chairs and just try to find a conversational groove. Believe me, I've never lost sight of the fact that these men have opened up a door after I knocked and have invited me, us, into their world, some looking back just handfuls of years and others looking back on moments four, five, six decades ago. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed doing these and how much I am now enjoying catching up with some old friends like today's guest. A little different today, and a moment of truth that pains me still to this day. You will hear in a couple of seconds a few minutes of a conversation I had with Frank Howard from 20 years ago. While I'm glad I have it, the truth is that more than half of this original conversation is lost, forever, trapped in a website that no longer exists, as if some sort of 2001 technological black hole. So instead of crying, okay, I might have, don't judge, and I thought about other conversations that suffered the same fate, I decided to buck up and try to make it right. So I took a chance. I called Frank. And not only did he pick up, he quickly became the Frank Howard I remember, overly generous with his time. And after I told him the following story, he told me, and I quote, "I must have made an impression on him if he offered me a smoke." Here's that story. First time I met Frank was in West Palm Beach, spring 1996. While I had gone to Braves camp for a few days in 1994, 1996 was my first full-time year covering spring training. Parked in a West Palm Beach motel for 5 weeks. Recently leaving chiropractic school as a student in good standing with 3 quarters left to go, I never went back, to really commit to radio after going to school full-time and working on the radio full-time here in Atlanta for the 3 previous years. Braves-Mets game. It's going to start a little late because of rain. I'd spoken to Frank for a few minutes earlier in the morning, and when the official word came down that play ball was going to be delayed, he saw me behind the Braves dugout and waved to me. I had asked if we might be able to catch up post-game to talk for a few minutes about his career, and I guess he figured this time might work for both of us. So I took my recorder and microphone down to third baseline as Frank was walking out to the left field area. Funny thing is, he kept walking past where I thought we were going to do this. I swear, while some of this is fuzzy, I do remember we ended up in a shed, like a tool shed, the kind that held lawnmowers, rakes, lime, and that piece of equipment that lines the field. So we're standing in a shed as he breaks out a heater. And again, I swear, he told me to keep this between us. He had some heart thing, and the Mets coaching staff wouldn't allow him to smoke in front of them or around them. And then he offered me a stick. Frank Howard, in his full Met uniform, offered me a cigarette. I didn't take it. And by the way, that's a top 3 or 4 regret in the 27 years I've been covering sports. But we did talk, and while I have no idea what that tape is, bothers me still, I do remember he was very self-effacing about his career, his talent, how he was just trying to get by in the majors for most of his time spent in it. Fast forward 25 years, a March Sunday in 2021, and Frank and I got together again. And nothing other than our ages had changed. His talent, 382 home runs, 1,100-plus RBI, Rookie of the Year in 1960, 2 top 5 MVP seasons, I think it was 4-time All-Star, all worth talking about. Thought so highly of, he has a statue outside of the Nationals ballpark, a beautiful piece of art imposing his 6'8" frame and his power captured in bronze. So when I asked if he would like to help me make it right, to make up for my stupidity for not having our previous conversations ready to put out as a podcast, he said he would love to talk with, his words, an old friend. Problem is, Frank doesn't do much talking about Frank. The good news is he does want to talk about others, how great today's athletes are, how great some of the men he played with and against were, how he learned from so many, but a few in particular that he felt compelled to expound on. He's 84 years old, and perhaps more beloved than ever in the baseball community. He is still known as a gentle giant to those who knew him back then. Oh, and Hondo, too, a nickname that was given to him by his Washington teammates in his first time up in 1958, a callback to a John Wayne character from a 1953 movie of the same name. Wait, the man is so imposing, he was also known as the Capital Punisher. That's a great nickname. Those are hard to find these days, and fitting as a Senators would paint seats white where his home runs landed, so far from home plate that most couldn't really comprehend that these were real markers of his exploits. Last thing, I posted on Twitter today that this episode was going to be dropping tonight. It was accompanied by a picture of Frank. Senator's jersey, short sleeves, and those arms just spilling out of it. Chipper Jones saw it and put it best. That's a bad man, with five A's between the B and D. And as I said, that tweet, well, I'm still smiling a full day after I recorded this. Frank Howard has that effect on people. Here he is, Frank Howard.
And along comes a jolly giant from Washington they call the Capital Punisher.
The pitch is a curve.
By a man who, well, when 40 home runs really meant something, this guy was doing it, and he did it pretty regularly there for a few years. He is Frank Howard, and he joins us tonight on Legends of the Game. Mr. Howard, how are you today?
Great, Chris. How are you doing?
Very good, sir. Now, when I introduced you, I mentioned when 40 home runs meant something. I am not discounting what 40 home runs is today, but it does happen a little bit more frequently today than it used to when you were playing.
Well, I tell you, Chris, we've got bigger, stronger athletes overall than we had 30, 40 years ago. The great players, the Aarons and the Mazes and the Frankie Robinsons, the Mantles, they would have played in any era. But today's young athlete, he's better educated. He has access to more data and utilizes that data much more so than we ever thought about. They have year-round conditioning programs. You look at today's athlete, most of them, their body fat's under 10%. My peers sometimes disagree with me. I'll be the first to admit, with 30 clubs as opposed to 16, certainly your team-to-team depth is probably a little thinner. But it doesn't detract from what some of these great young players are doing today. I look around and I see this Mark McGuire, 6'5", 260 pounds, and I mean, there's not an ounce of fat on him. Barry Bonds, who is the Mays of the 90s, Griffey, who is the Mantle of the 90s and the Millennium, they're 6'4", they're 220 pounds. Now today, we have a tendency not to give today's ball player enough credit.
Now, you're still around the game, but let's talk about size. I believe you came in at about 6'8". Were you the tallest player in the major leagues when you were playing?
Well, I'm sure I was.
Yeah.
I'm sure I was. Normally, 30 years ago, I would be considered almost a freak, because most ball players are 6'1", 6', 6'2". But in today's game, we got a lot of guys 6'5", 6'6" playing.
Now, you were a basketball player at Ohio State, All-American, I believe, in both basketball and baseball. Were you drafted by the NBA?
No, we didn't have the draft. Oh, by the NBA?
Yeah.
Well, yes, I was, but I was already in pro ball, and my first contract with the Los Angeles Dodgers stipulated that I would only try to go the one way. To be honest with you, Chris, I think had I chosen basketball, I would have played in the NBA. I chose baseball because it was my love, and I played in the major leagues. Had I tried to go both ways, I don't think I would have made it in either sport. I think that Red Auerbach, who is a man 50 years ahead of his time, I remember in 1965 we were talking, and he said, well, Frank, when we were with the Celtics, we wanted to draft you. You were our type of player, but we knew you were going to play pro baseball. And he says, the day of the multi-sport athlete he thought was coming to a close, even in the middle 60s. He thought that if a guy or a man wants to choose a professional sports as a career, I think he's got to find, number one, the game that he loves the best, and then devote his entire energies and his entire drive toward acquiring that goal.
Now, what kind of player do you think you would have been in the NBA?
Well, then I would have been a strong forward. Now I'm not big enough to even play a point guard. There again, you know, you've got, you know, in 40 years ago, you had maybe a handful of guys consistently play above the rim. Now everybody does. You got point guards that are 6 foot one or two that are leaping right out of the gymnasium. And there's no equipment. You got better equipment. You got better year-round conditioning programs. You get your athletes today that they don't take much time off. I mean, their season's over. They might take a month to kick back and relax, but then they get right back into the grind of training. And it behooves them with today's salary structure. It behooves a kid to take better care of himself.
Why do you think you like baseball better than basketball?
I don't know. You know, and I was probably really at that stage a much better basketball player than was baseball player.
I
loved baseball. I didn't know much about it.
Would basketball have been more of a sure thing professionally for you, do you think?
Well, but you know, 45, 50 years ago at that time, the best salary structure for an athlete was in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly these other games have their structure economically has risen to the point where, you know, if a kid's got a basketball ability, he becomes a wealthy man, same way in baseball or the NFL or anything else, golf, tennis, soccer.
Do you think it was an upbringing thing that you were more attuned to enjoy baseball?
I think so. You know, baseball was the game mm-hmm. at that time. And
where did you grow up?
In Columbus, Ohio.
And so you were an Ohio State guy. You were
right
an in-state
your own
guy.
Backyard.
Mm-hmm. So that was that a pretty easy choice for you?
Well, yeah, it was. I was. There were really probably only three or four major schools that were. My skills were very crude at that time, and there were only three or four major schools that were, you know, interested in recruiting me. I had a chance to go down to North Carolina State with Vic Bubas, who I consider one of the great athletic directors and coaches of our time. He give me the opportunity to play both ways, baseball and basketball. But, you know, they aren't going to let too many Columbus boys get out of their backyard if they can help it.
Now, what kind of high school baseball player were you?
You know, believe it or not, there again, you know, crude. I was... started out as a shortstop, and I outgrew it, and later went to third base and did a little pitching. But I guess there were a few organizations that were interested in signing me out of high school, but my development at that stage was mm-hmm. way back. I might not even made out of pro ball. So a couple of years of college really helped me refine my skills to the point where, you know, I signed and went into pro ball.
Talking to Frank Howard tonight on Legends of the Game on Parkball. And Mr. Howard, I'm always curious because, you know, bat, the idea of what type of bat to use has certainly changed, and you're still around the game today. What size bat did you use for most of your career?
Well, I use a 37-inch, 35-ounce bat.
Do they even make those today?
Oh, I doubt it. You know, today, you know, we had, there again, when you're talking about different eras and the, I think we probably had as many or more hard throwers that relied on their fastball in those days. But you had basically a three or four pitch pitcher, fastball, slider, curveball, change. Today, today's pitcher's got two types of fastballs, four-seam fastball rider, two-seam sinker. They've got two different speeds of the slider, two different speeds of a curveball, or two different types of changes. I think it's a little tougher hitting today, and I think as a result, I think guys have gone to lighter bats only because it allows them that luxury of waiting to the last possible second before they release their
swing. Do you think if somebody would have explained that to you back in your day, you would have bought into that whole lighter bat
speed
thing?
Well, I think if I were playing today and had to face the type of pitchers that they have today, I think I probably would have gone to a lighter bat.
But what if somebody told you in 1960, hey, Frank, you know, that bat's too big, whatever too big means. Do you think you would have bought into that whole theory of smaller bat?
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Because I'd imagine at 6'8", your hands are probably bigger where handle. I know a lot of guys like to use the Whippet thin handle. I'm assuming 37, 35, you had a pretty good size handle on that.
Well, it was a medium handle. It was, it was that R43. I think that's the Babe Ruth model. And my old team, Babe Moose Cowan, got me using it. And I thought I had great balance, and it was something I could handle.
Talking to Frank Howard tonight. Now let's talk about some of your teammates, the L.A. Dodgers in 1958, the first year they move out to Los Angeles. And you guys do win the World Series in 63. You had a couple of teammates of note in those first early years.
Well, you know, the Koufaxes and the Drysdales and the Snyders, they fit into that category, Chris, and I don't want to sound self-depreciating, but they fit into that category, those type of players, the Aarons and the Mazes, and you go on and name 1,000 guys. They play a level or two above us mere mortals. But to grow up being associated with them, and they teach you how to conduct yourself as a big league player, what to give the clubhouse man based on what you know your salary you're making, how to handle your equipment and take care of it and not embarrass him by throwing it all over the clubhouse. I think they give you the big league way of carrying yourself, and big league is not only ability, but I think it's the way you interact with people. It's the it's the way you interact with the fans, the press, and I know that there again a lot of your super players, they're hammered all the time, besieged all the time. I know that gets a little weary, but it goes with the territory. And most of them, and I think in today's business, I think most of them handle it very well. You know, I watched McGuire when he was breaking that record, and the way he conducted himself on radio, TV, things like that, and I thought to myself, boy, his mom and dad has done a great job of raising this guy. I thought he handled it very well.
Do you remember in the middle of Roger Maris's assault in 61? Obviously, you weren't in the
Yankee
clubhouse.
No, I was in the National League.
Right, but do you remember, were players, I mean, were you talking about that nightly? Were you keeping your own little watch? If it wasn't as big a media push.
I think when it got to mid-August, and it's the same way with Bonds, this man's he's a phenomenal player. He's just a phenomenal player. But I think you get to the middle of August and he's pushing 58 or 60 in the middle of August, then you got something that's going to keep the baseball world a-buzzing on a daily basis. I think it's probably still a little too early to put a lot of pressure on him or to try to take him out of his mold, his everyday mold.
Do you remember how nervous were you when you put on your Major League uniform for the first time?
Well, I only played a year and a half in the minor leagues, and like I said, I really didn't know that much about baseball.
Did you think
the
you were ready?
The good pitchers, the real professionals, this Robin Roberts and the Spahns and those guys that are really artists out there, they can make a young, inexperienced hitter make him look like he's never played the game of baseball. But certainly there's a... I think the two toughest years for any big league player are, number one, his first year, where most of us maybe have a little apprehension or doubt about whether we can compete successfully at that level. And then the last year, when he's starting to lose his reflex or has lost his reflexes, and he can't do some of the things he did in the best years of his life.
And you know what's really strange, Mr. Howard, isn't the common thread between those 2 years the idea of being found out? You're just afraid you're going to be found out that you're not supposed to be doing this?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that to give yourself any chance at success, I think you've got to have absolute confidence in your ability, even when things are going real tough for you. And they go tough for all of us. Like I said, I've been 2 for 22 all my life. But that's where I think the mind and the fire and your belly and your heart comes out. In the development of today's young players, if you look at a feeder system, let's say you got 150 ball players in your farm system, roughly 10.8% is going to make it to the big league. So that's 15 players. Five of them are probably going to have a cup of coffee, up and down, up and down. Five of them are probably going to fill a spot role or a utility type role. And five of them are going to have an impact on your ball club. But the ones that do make it, besides having skills, major, what we call major league skills or above average major league skills, the ones that make it are those guys that I think are totally focused about the game of baseball. I think they're they've got a mental toughness about them that nobody is going to beat them, or nobody's going to keep from being a top performer at that level. And I think that's the thing that a young man's got to either, and it can be developed, I think, through concentration, and I think through paying attention to your business. I think you can develop a mental toughness. I mean, I've sat and seen so many great players, and their concentration spans are so enormous, and so and they're consistent day in and day out.
Were you a guess hitter?
No, but after you're in the league, you'll have a pretty good idea of how a guy's been pitching. If he's had success getting you out, he's going to stay with the same type of pitches, the same pattern. If you've had a little luck with him, chances are he's going to change his location, maybe change the sequence of pitches to you. We call it a guessing game. Ted Williams called it a figuring game, but when you hit 344 lifetime, it's pretty good figuring.
Now, you, though, hold a major league record. I think it's still yours and yours alone. You hit 10 home runs in a 20 at-bat stretch over a six-game period, correct?
Yes.
Is that describable to, as you would say, a mere mortal such as myself,
well,
as to what that run is?
That's one week where I could say I played with the big boys. You'd like to have had, I'd like to have had 10 or 12 streaks like that in my career. But
well, nobody has streaks like that in their career.
Well,
that's the point.
You know what? A couple writers call me, Chris, when Bonds, he had, nine and six games, when he was pushing it. And like I try to explain it, in those days you had two radio and television guys. You had two guys that covered you in the media, the papers. Nobody thought much about things like that. But today, with all your media attention and the enormous media focus, it's on the front page and on the news every night. And a guy asked me, would have upset you if he hit 11 in six games? Not at all. We've got, like I said, we've got great young people playing our game today, and records are made to be broken. And if he hit 11, nobody had been happier for him than me. Now, his father is a pretty good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, the young man comes from pretty good bloodlines. And I met Barry, but I just a couple years ago when I was coaching the National League, but I knew his father very well. And when you see that kind of talent out there and some of the things that he does, or not only him, but all these great players do on a baseball field, it certainly wouldn't have surprised me if he had 10 or 12 in six games.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Mr. Howard.
Hello, Chris.
Hello,
go
Mr.
ahead.
Okay.
What's up?
I'm well. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for spending a few minutes. I just, it was great to catch up with you. I just wanted to find out sort of how you're doing these days and talk a little bit about your career.
Well, that sounds like a good idea. I'm doing all right. I'm in the bottom of the seventh or top of the eighth inning of my lifetime. We got a one-run lead. I'm hoping they tie it up and we play 25 innings. In other words, I'd like to live to be 100. But go ahead, Chris. Everything is fine.
Good. How much do you enjoy looking back at your life and your career and thinking about some of the things and the people and the games and that part of your life? Do you look back on it with as much enjoyment as I hope you do?
Chris, I really don't dwell that much on my life in baseball. I look at it this way. I said, the two or three things. We run kind of a gauntlet. As a player, you're signed, you're traded, you're sold, you're released. you get into the coaching end of it, and I coached for over 20 years in the big leagues, you're hired. There's a pretty good chance somewhere along the way you're going to get fired. But that goes with the territory. But I look back and I talk to a lot of my peers that I either played with or coached with, and we're all in kind of an agreement. You know, the two or three things that has not gone our way in the game of baseball, there's been 1,000 great things happen. Mm-hmm. And we've met more than 1,000 great people inside and outside of baseball. So where's our bitch? Where's our, you know, we got none. It's been a roller coaster ride. A lot of ups, a lot of downs, but boy, it's been a great time in our lifetime.
You were fortunate enough, though, to play in an era starting in the 50s and through the, you know, early 70s, where it's arguably the greatest era of baseball in terms of talent. I mean, there was overlap from guys who played in the 40s who were still around in the 50s. There's certainly an unbelievable amount of great players in the 60s, and it sort of bleeds into those players who made their debut in the late 60s and early 70s. It really was an incredible piece of time for the game itself in terms of the talent, was it not?
Well, there's no question. The salary structure in those days isn't anything like it is today, but baseball probably paid a little more money than the NBA or the National Football League or the National at that time. At that time, probably paid a little. So as a result, we got a lot of the great athletes of that moment in baseball simply because the pay scale was a little higher. But now that it's all come around, there are all these young people today who are doing some things on these athletic fields that are simply awe-inspiring. I mean, I'm watching some of these young athletes today run, jump, shoot the basketball, hit the baseball, passing. I watched that young quarterback at Kansas City. And he comes from pretty good genes. His dad was an outstanding major league pitcher. But, I mean, he's throwing a football overhand, throwing a football sidearm, throwing a football underhand, submarine style, and completing passes. You look at LeBron James and some of these athletes playing in the NBA. You look at some of these hockey players. You know, you go from my era of a Gordie Howe, a Bobby Hull, Jacques Plante, those guys, John Béliveau, Maurice Richard. You go from there, you go into the Bobby Orrs. Then you go to the Gretzky's. Then you go to these, the kid we got, he's not a kid, this young man we got in Washington, Russian skater, what's his name?
Ovechkin?
Yes. And then you go to Pittsburgh with Crosby. Mm-hmm. What we're dealing with in today's world, we're dealing with, well, for different reasons. Better equipment, probably better coaching, more access to film, more access to intel with this computer world we live in. And they're taking advantage of it. Better diets. What we're dealing with, and I don't debate it with my peers out of the respect, the genuine respect that I have for them. But what we're dealing with today, Chris, we're dealing with bigger, faster, stronger athletes overall. Now, your Hall of Fame players in any sport, whether it be hockey, whether it be baseball, NFL, NBA, your Hall of Fame players, they would have played in any era. But the masses in today's athletic world, they're bigger, faster, and stronger.
So, Frank, what was it like to be 21, though? You go to Los Angeles, and you're a Midwestern kid, and it's the first year the Dodgers are in L.A., and you do get a cup of coffee up there. What's it like to be 21 in Los Angeles when baseball is brand new on the West Coast?
Well, there again, you're talking about a different environment. In those days, San Diego was a beautiful city, but didn't really have that at that time. The population count, the growth that it's got now, San Francisco, oh, marvel, the Paris of the United States, and Los Angeles, where all the movie stars and the glamour and all that was there. It was a great time. It was a great time in my life. It should have been a great time in other athletes' lives.
So to be 21, though, I mean, there's, listen, it's a tough world. Everybody's on a one-year contract if they're on that. You know, in 1960, when you become an everyday player, you win Rookie of the Year, so you must have been paying attention in 58 and 59.
The thing that helped me, I want you to think about something. Now, we're not talking about a race of people. We're talking about a breed of ball player. We're talking about the Latin American pelotero, the Latin American ball player. Can you imagine playing Clemente, Cepeda, Juan Terrien Pizarro, Titi Arroyo, the Alouz in the Dominican, got in Cuba before Castro put. Can you imagine how many great baseball players came off those islands? Now, the thing that really helped me, because I was more noted more for being a basketball player than a baseball player at that time, the thing that helped me, I played 4 years in the winter. Played baseball year-round, 4 years. I played 4 years in Latin America. I played a year in Mexico. I played a year in the Dominican Republic in the wintertime. I played 2 years in Puerto Rico. The thing that helped me playing year-round is that you'll learn how to compete, because if you can't compete and put numbers up, they'll get you out of there in a hurry. But can you imagine Orlando Cepeda playing 18 years in the big league? Luis Tejon. pitching 18 years. Can you imagine pitching 18 years there and then playing another 12, 15 years in Latin America? So it's repetition in your skill areas until you reach whatever ability level God has in mind for you. So it will hone your skills. We wonder why that sure double, possible triple in the right field corner, line drive that you know you can't cut off, where you've got to take a little drop step to put you in a running route that might help you cut the ball off 15 or 20 feet back of you. Can you imagine sure double, possible triple, and that ball's hitting the right field, and the great Roberto Clemente take a little drop step back, get him in a running route where he cuts the ball off 15 or 20 feet behind him, makes a play, makes a little U-turn, throws a one-hop strike to second base, and that's your double, possible triple. You're out and going back to the dugout. But they've done it in practice 1,000 times, and they've done it under game condition 100 times. So they're very, very skilled. Cepeda with that real tough slider down and away. They call them bastard pitches. It's a bastard pitch to me. To him, he hits it off the right center field wall for a double or in the right center field seats. Repetition in your skill areas. That's the key. Repeat until you either master that particular part of the game or at least brings you up to whatever ability levels you have.
Frank, were you aware, it sounds like
It sounds like you were astutely aware, and I don't know at what age it might have started early in your career, about the abilities of other players, where you're watching other players, it sounds like. And believe me, I know your career as a coach, so your ability to watch and communicate is certainly in play because you're around the game for as long as you were. But did you realize as a young player some of the things you're talking about now? And I don't want to say you were in awe, but you were aware of how good the average baseball player was, and then take the next step up where you're watching greatness night in, night out?
Well, personally, if I had to do all over again, I would have prepared for a game a little better. I would have paid a little more attention to who's pitching, how they pitching me. Now, I finally did grasp that, but I was 27, 28 years old. So not that I wasted 4 or 5 years, but I didn't have the years that I should have had I paid a little more attention to detail. You know, you can talk about let's take a guy that just recently passed. Undoubtedly one of the greatest, if not the greatest, one of the greatest hitters to ever play the game of baseball. And I worked for him. He was a farm director in Atlanta when I was the minor league hitting coordinator, Henry Aaron. Now, Henry Aaron, before he's 25 years old, playing in Milwaukee, led the National League. Look it up, Chris. I know he led it once. He might have led it twice in average, batting average. What? Can you look it up real quick?
I am. I'm doing it right now, as a matter of fact, and believe me.
He's 25 years old, living well, the crosswinds in County Stadium. Tough, you know, you couldn't defend him. He played chalk line to chalk line.
He did it twice. He led the National League in hitting as a 22-year-old and a 25-year-old.
You see what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he led the National League in hitting. Had he spent his entire career in Milwaukee, he'd have probably led it 8 or 10 times in batting average. But he went to Atlanta Fulton County Stadium and opened up a little bit, give you the outside inch or two of the plate down and away. But 2-3/4 of the plate in, he'd either bounce that ball, prevailing winds blowing to left field. He hit that ball off the left field wall or in the left field seats. Changed his style of hitting a little bit to take advantage of the elements. Now, that's not only baseball skill, that's baseball acumen. Now, I'll tell you something else about Henry Aaron. If they don't have Bill Bruton, who was a great defensive center fielder playing in Milwaukee, Henry Aaron would have been one of the great center fielders of all time.
And it's what a lot of people said. Well, if he was such a great athlete, why wasn't he playing in center? And look, Mickey and Willie both had a little bit of an advantage with the New York media and how they perceived and how they were written about. But you're not the first person to tell me Hank Aaron doesn't have to take a backseat to anybody. Not statistically.
He's a 5-tool player.
Yeah.
Now, the epitome of the 5-tool player could beat you glove, foot speed, bat contact, bat power, and what were we talking about? Bat
arm.
Power, foot speed,
arm
strength. Henry Aaron didn't have an outstandingly strong arm like a Kaline or a Clemente, but he was very accurate, very accurate. But then, you know, the epitome of the 5-tool, and there were more than just two of them. There were. Yastrzemski, 5-tool player. Kaline, 5-tool player. Clemente, 5-tool player. Aaron, 5-tool player. Frank Robinson, before he hurt his arm, 5-tool player. But the two guys that come to mind are, as 5-tool players are Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays, or Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, whatever order you want to put them in. But now to show you where the growth and the development comes in. Now, all the years I coached, I thought the two, and there were other 5-tool players, but I thought the two players that epitomized the 5-tool player of my coaching end would be Barry Bonds and Ken Griffey Jr. Now, Mays, 5'11", 6 foot tall, 185 pounds. Mantle, 6 foot tall, 210 pounds. You got Bonds at 6'3", 6'4". Griffey at 6'4". 215, 220, 225. They're just bigger, faster, and stronger. Better diets. Better, you know, better training regimens. But it was a great era, Chris. I don't disagree with what's going on in baseball today with all the computer technology and everything. I think you're crazy if you don't utilize it.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Right, because look, everybody said it's hard. The expression has always been, and this started before you started playing, hard to get there, harder to stay.
And that's true.
And I've watched guys, Frank, quite honestly, they lazy themselves out of a career. They drink themselves out of careers.
Well, there again, to show you how today's, I think, is smarter. They take better care of themselves. They take better care of themselves. They have better diets. They don't have the heavy drinkers. They cleaned up the narcotics end of it. They cleaned up the juice end of it through education, personal awareness. All those problems that we've had in baseball have been correct, or most of them have been corrected anyway.
So tell me a little bit about a couple of your teammates in Los Angeles. By the way, you're playing in the Coliseum before they finish up.
First 4 years in the Coliseum.
Tell me about that building itself.
The Coliseum?
Yeah.
Well, short left field fence, big home plate ran from the tunnel all the way to the big arches in center field. But down the left field line, 254 feet with a 40-foot screen. Left center was only 310 with that. The screen was still there. Then it went to 420 in dead center field, 390 in right center field, 360 in dead right field, and 300 feet down the line. But you'd have to pull a ball, within 10 feet of the right field foul line for it to be any trouble.
So when you play 81 games in that ballpark, though, can that screw you up a little bit? I've had guys tell me, look, Fenway's a great place to hit as long as you know that it's 81 games maybe of approach. Can the Coliseum or a building like that sort of screw you up a little bit?
Well, no, I don't think so. Wally Moon, one of the really great fastball hitters of all time, he changed his style. He could pull anybody's fastball. Pull it. That's how much bat speed he had. But he kind of changed his style of hitting and started using more of the opposite field with that short fence out there. I think he had his best year home run-wise, hitting about 15 out there. It was about 25 doubles. So they take advantage of Aaron took advantage of Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. Mays took advantage of Candlestick Park because of the currents blowing from home plate to the right field. Willie Mays could pull anybody, everyone, but they're sharp. They operate a level or two above us, mere mortals. And they're sharp in that, hey, I'm going to stay inside the baseball a little bit. If I hit a ball to to the right of center field, it's got a chance to go.
Are you happy that you played in both the National and American League because you got to see different cities and ballparks? You know, back in the day, a lot of guys were one-team guys, or if they stayed in the league without interleague play, you really didn't get a chance to experience the other cities and the other ballparks.
Well, see, they're playing in the American League probably a little better for me than playing in the National League. Two very distinct, different strike zones. In those days, the American League had the big ballparks. So you had guys that threw four-seam fastballs, riding them upstairs with a curveball to take you back and forth. Fastball, high fastballs, curveball, take you back and forth. National League was a smaller ballpark, sinker and fastball down, hard slider down, nothing. Didn't throw you too much soft stuff. So the American League is probably a little better league for me, Chris, because I was a little better high fastball hitter.
So tell me, let me ask you about a couple of your teammates. I'll start with Los Angeles, and I do want to ask you about a couple of other guys as well, if you're okay with that. Tell me a little bit about Sandy and watching Sandy Koufax go from being the guy who really, you couldn't put the baseball in his hand every 4 days, but then all of a sudden you never wanted the baseball out of his hand. He got that good. He had maybe the greatest five-year run in baseball history.
Well, I've had people ask me, and this is just my opinion. If you want to combine sheer velocity with a great curveball, sheer velocity with a great, two guys come to mind, in my mind. You got Sanford Koufax and you got Nolly Ryan, or Nolly Ryan, Sanford Koufax, whatever order you want to put them in. Now, there have been guys with as good a curveball, Bly Levin, Ernie Broglio, Sam Jones, who else? Been a lot of guys with Camilo Pasquale. A lot of guys with a curveball is good, but didn't quite have that velocity. Then you had guys that probably threw just as hard, but didn't have that curveball. If you wanted to combine fastball, curveball, Nolly Ryan and Sanford Koufax come to mind. If they've got command of both pitches, subject to no hitting you every time they go out there.
What about Sandy Koufax, the guy?
The word I would use is presence. Presence. Walk into a room, people are raising cane, can't hear yourself think. Sanford Koufax walk into a room, you watch it, and you can hear a pin drop. And somebody, they're all going to say, there's Sandy Koufax, there's Sandy Koufax. Presence, professional, very professional, very professional. Great game preparation. That's why I said those guys, they operate a level or two above us. They not only have great skill, but they utilize that. Tom Seaver. Talk about a pro's pro. A great work ethic. Could handle a bat for a pitcher. Outstanding command of all of his pitches. And made a transition. Made a transition from power pitcher to professional control type pitcher. You know, some guys can't do that, but you're talking about guys that they really do. They just they're a level. They play a level or two above us.
What about Drysdale?
Give him the baseball every 4 days, and he's going to pitch. You imagine this guy? No, I want you to look up his record. I think he had 8 or 10 years where he pitched 280 innings plus. Look it up.
I'm looking right now. Let's see. 314, 315, 321, 308, 273, 282, and right before that, 269. So, yeah, on average, better than 295. For about 8 years.
Well, are you going to see that today?
No, sir. No, sir.
We were playing in Puerto Rico. We go to the finals for the championship, is San Juan Cito Escobar Stadium. Juan Terrien Pizarro, who could get that baseball as a young man from the pitcher's mound to home plate as good as anybody. He told about velocity. Mm-hmm. He under that radar gun threw about 95, 96. I saw Juan Terrien Pizarro beat my guy, our guy, Luis Tion, 1-0 in 12 or 13 innings. Now, get a little of this, Chris. Probably 30, 35 pitches warming up. 13 innings at 10, 11, 12 pitches an inning. They probably unloaded 170-plus pitches that night. Now, neither one of them ever thought about coming out of that game. I'm either going to beat you or I'm not going to beat you. Can you imagine a manager walking out to the mound with Donnie Drysdale hooked up against Bob Gibson and they're going into the 10th inning 1-1? Can you imagine saying how you feel? You know what they tell you, don't you?
Yeah, get the hell out of here.
Get the hell out of here.
Get the hell out of here.
Winner or loser.
There's a story about Warren Spahn and Juan Marichal in the game.
Well,
that
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Intel is great, but sometimes you can't. It will never cede taking the human element out of a sports game or an athletic event.
So you're in Los Angeles when there were some guys left, and I don't know what you know. I know that you were an Ohio State basketball player. You chose baseball over basketball. I don't know how big a baseball fan you were growing up. But I got to ask about the Brooklyn Dodger holdovers. There's Duke Snyder. There's Gil Hodges. There's a couple other guys. Johnny Padres.
Pee Wee Reese.
Yeah, you're around
Erskine,
those guys.
Clem Levine.
Padres.
Johnny Padres. Gil and Duke. You know what they do? They create a great family atmosphere for a young guy. They show you the right way to go, where to put your uniform after the game, put it in the bins. We don't throw it on the floor. Your shoes need to be clean. Cleats, put them outside your locker. Your clubhouse people will get to them. They give you a good professional base to operate by.
And you guys had a bunch of young guys. I mean, when you talk about Willie Davis, Maury Wills, yourself, it really was an incredible mix those first few years of young.
Well, I'm going to tell you about another guy out there that led the league twice in hitting before he's 25 years old, Tommy Davis. Look him up.
Tommy Davis led the league back-to-back years at 23 and 24, 346
right.
And 326.
Before he's 25.
Yeah.
Now, if he doesn't break his ankle up in the sand, I was gone. They traded me that winter. I was in the American League at 65. If he didn't break his ankle up in San Francisco when he's 25, probably leads that league five or six, seven times in hitting. Outside, from the right side of the plate, probably the second fastest, or maybe the fastest guy in the National League from home plate to first base. The other guy might run with him would be Julian Javier from the Cardinals, but from the right side of the plate, you know.
So can I give you a piece of information about Tommy Davis?
What about him?
He's 82 years old today, sir. He's literally celebrating.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll tell you, we were on a cruise together. It's been 10 years ago. Had a great, great time visiting. But if he didn't break his ankle, he could hit more tough two-strike pitches than any guy I've ever seen. You know, we talk about a two-strike approach to hitting. Well, that's in 150 years of Major League Baseball history, you can probably count probably two dozen great two-strike hitters. Most of us, 1-2, 0-2, we don't operate too well. But Tommy Davis, one of the great two-strike hitters of all time, Williams would be in that category. Who else? Boggs.
When?
No question about it. You're right. You're right. But then, there again, you're talking about skill levels that they're well above average and developed through years and years of repetition. You know, they asked my old manager, Ted Williams, if you had to do all over again, would you do anything different? He said, yes, I'd take more batting practice. Now, who took more batting practice than Ted Williams? But there again, refining and honing those skills. Repetition, repetition, repetition.
You actually played for both Gil Hodges and Ted Williams in Washington. I
mean, yeah.
Let me ask you about Gil Hodges. Gil Hodges was a teammate. Gil Hodges was a Dodger royalty. Then Gil Hodges is your manager after you guys had been teammates.
There are a lot of great managers, and I've worked for a lot of great managers, coached for them. Dick Williams, Dallas Green, George Bamberger, Dick Williams. I thought that they all knew the game of baseball from A to Z and back from Z to A. All their I's were dotted and their T's were crossed. Totally prepared. But I thought the two guys that come to mind that I thought had the greatest peripheral vision and depth perception of a baseball field were Gil Hodges and Dick Williams. I thought they saw things. I used to say, God damn, they must have eyes in their ass. They saw things that we'd pick up once a year, if we're lucky, once a season. They pick them up every day. No question about it.
Now, he was but he's a military guy. He was my dad's favorite player. My dad was born and raised in Brooklyn. I was raised hearing stories about the Brooklyn Dodgers. So Gil Hodges was, and by the way, you couldn't have asked for a more perfect fit because you know the game big picture. When he goes over to the Mets with a very young team that, you know, quite honestly, losing sucks, and that team had been sort of clownish for a while. Can you imagine Gil Hodges walking in there his first spring training to let people know that this isn't funny anymore? We're not here to entertain people that way.
Well, look what he did with the Washington Club. There wasn't anything wrong with the Washington Club. We had guys that could fundamentally sound, could play. We just didn't have enough of them, that's all. Mm-hmm. Look at the improvement he made in that Washington Club when he went there, in 65 or 66? When did he go to Washington?
So Gil. He was there in, I think he was 65.
Yeah.
65. Yeah, 1965 is his first year in Washington.
Look at his records in Washington. They got better every year, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. And the Mets made a brilliant move by getting him over to New York at that point.
Well, you know, there again, you're talking about guys that they know what they just got it, I guess. I don't know.
So what was it like to play for Ted?
Oh, really an American icon. Not only a baseball icon. Can you imagine a guy spend five and a half prime playing years of his career in the United States Naval Marines, World War II, the Korean War? Can you imagine what he might have done hadn't he spent those 5.5 years there? But a great patriot, He told me one time, he said, take all this baseball stuff and put it in its place. The greatest thrill I've ever got in my life was being a United States Naval Marine.
I had a chance to speak to him, and that sort of towards the end of our conversation was the idea that, hey, wearing a baseball uniform was incredible, but it wasn't the greatest uniform he ever wore, is what he told me.
Well, I'll tell you, he's an amazing guy. He really is. Amazing man. Light years, like Auerbach, like Belichick, like Lombardi, like Scotty Bowman. Those guys are light in their careers as managers. They're light years ahead of everybody else. They utilize everything they have.
Well, as you said, look, here's, tell me if this is fair. When you get to play Major League Baseball in any era, you're the 1% of the 1% of the 1%. But there is that 1% higher that become the guys that a lot of the people we just talked about, where they're just, you know, you don't want to say they're touched by the gods, but there is something a little bit different about them. And then they usually work on top of that to ensure that they stay. Once you taste greatness, I don't know why anybody would want to throw greatness away, so you work harder. It's not everybody has done it, but the greats of the greats all seem to have that attribute.
Oh, they, what they've got, Chris, I could probably describe it, but I watch them. They're not only skillful, talented guys, but they're also very smart about what they're doing. Great baseball, great sports acumen, great sports heart, great sports stomach, fire in their belly. How about Pete Rose? Now, let's take this guy. If you had to evaluate him as a young player, you say arm strength probably average, glove probably average, bat power below average, running speed above average as a young player, bad contact. But if you could open up Pete Rose in his mind, in his heart, in his belly, you say this guy is, when we evaluate 20 to 80, most clubs do, mm-hmm. 20 to 80, major league average 50, any would be McGuire power, Juan Pierre speed.
Clemente's arm.
Clemente's arm, you're right, Kaline's arm, mm-hmm. Calavito's arm. You'd have to give him an 80 in all the, give Pete Rose an 80 in all mind, heart, and belly. Took his skills to the maximum. Took his baseball skill, but there again, through great work ethic, great worth ethic.
Was there a guy or two that you ended up getting to know? Look, you competed in four All-Star games, which is a completely different type of clubhouse, and it wasn't a lot of fraternization in the 50s and certainly in the 60s, but when you got in that room, and believe me, the National League owned the All-Star game for a number of years for a number of different reasons. What's it like to walk into an All-Star room?
Well, I don't know how they vote today. I think they used to vote fan favorite, and then they got into an era where I think the managers and coaches put in a vote. I don't know how that works. To be selected by your peers to play an All-Star, it's a thrill. It's like playing in a World Series. I say this. What we do as individuals will never supersede playing on a World Championship club. To be recognized. This is America. They love winners. And we play to win. We don't play to lose. We play to win. But to be on a World Championship club is probably the greatest thrill an athlete can ever experience.
And you did. So how much of your career, look, Ernie Banks, Ted Williams, there have been a number of guys who didn't, if they tasted the World Series, they didn't win the World Series. How much better do you think most players feel walking away with that memory on top or on the back of the baseball card?
I couldn't tell you. I wouldn't know. I'm just speaking for myself now. You'll probably get more recognition playing on a World Championship club than you'll ever get maybe for being as an individual.
And that matters to players. There's a certain point.
I think it does.
Yeah.
I think it does. How about that quarterback at New England? Well, he was in New England.
Yeah, Tom Brady. He just wants to win.
Well, look, I'm telling you, he's 42, 43 years old. He's played on six World Championship clubs. And besides his great talent and skill, he's got a great football acumen, great football heart, a great football belly. If firing his belly. He was firing that guy's belly. I mean, what it is, Chris, that it's not only, it goes beyond just skill. You certainly got to have ability and skill, but they've got intangibles that make them there again, that let them operate above us mere mortals.
When you're in your prime and you feel good, you're on a good run, does it matter who the pitcher is? I know you have to know what it is they throw. I mean, there are times, look, this game is tough. Three hits and 10 at-bats, you're going to the Hall of Fame. So the psychological part of the game, when you're going well as opposed to when you're not going well.
Well, you get into those. I asked Harmon Killebrew one time. We got to talk about him. I said, you know, we go on those little tears every now and then where you're really swinging the bat well and really moving hard on that baseball. But then somewhere along the line, you put in your mind, well, this can't go on forever. And you know what Harmon's answer was? He said, why can't it? You know, I got to thinking about it. I said, damn, no wonder this guy is so they think it should happen every day. And most of us say, well, I'll do what I can do as long as I can do it.
Yeah.
Then I'll be back in those 2-for-22s again.
So what kind of disadvantage is it to be 6'7"? What's the advantage and what's the disadvantage in baseball to be 6'7"?
Well, in the era that I played, I would almost be considered kind of freakish. 6'7", we got a strike zone as big as my den, my kid, my house, my home. In today's world, today I look like Demi Dimwit against some of these guys.
Well, it is,
they're
against
shy.
Yeah.
They got those. I've never seen either one of them play, but they got those two big boys there with the Yankees.
Stan and Judge.
Yeah. 6'5", 6'6", 250, 60 pounds. And can run, can throw, can field. You know, so talented, so much talent, bigger, faster, and stronger.
How often did you get knocked down? Were you a guy who got knocked down a lot?
You know, that's probably overrated. Certainly, they probably pitch a little more inside than they do today. But it's never, I don't think it's, occasionally, sure, you're going to get flipped. You know, if you want to really come up and in on a hitter, all you got to do is either just nip him in there up and in or miss up and in. You go under his lead elbow. Just go throw pitch right under his lead elbow. He'll either put you on the black end there or put it in inside off the plate a couple inches. I don't think he had as much of it as people made out to me.
Yeah, it's a story. It happened, but it's a story this many years that's grown, I'm assuming, just like a lot of other things in life.
Yeah.
The story gets a little bit bigger. All right, let me finish up with this. In your time in the American League, there's Jim Palmer and that group of guys. It's an incredible era for Hall of Fame pitchers. Was there a Hall of Fame pitcher that you hit really well? Was there a that caliber type guy that you know you hit well?
I don't think he hit those guys too well, Chris. I thought Jimmy, there again, talk about a very mechanically fluid motion. I thought Jim Palmer at 19 had one of the great moving fastballs of anybody I had seen. But he offset it with a lot of people don't realize it, had a great curveball. Well, then you combine velocity with that kind of a breaking ball and that kind of command of that stuff. That's why they're in Cooperstown.
Yeah. So would you know who you hit more home runs off of? Without bragging, is there a guy that you know you hit well? That you drove to the ballpark a little bit quicker on the days that
maybe
you
No, I never thought about
no.
that.
Was there a guy you didn't like facing?
I couldn't tell you. I really couldn't.
Was there a guy you didn't like facing? Was there a guy in particular?
I could probably name you 250 of them.
Well, listen, you did something right, Frank. I mean,
once in a while, we touch one off.
And by the
once in a while, we touch one off.
When you hit them far.
Once in a while.
Do you think you ever really hit a baseball 500 feet? Is that such a thing?
Oh, there's no question in my mind I did.
Okay. So tell me what hitting a 500-foot-plus home run is like.
Well, you know, we didn't have the tape measures in those days. But, you know, and there again, I'm not a scientist. But, you know, they tell you where the ball went and all that. You don't see it. You don't see where they go. You make contact and you start hauling ass. But
it is incredible. I'm assuming when you know an outfielder doesn't move, that's when you know you hit a home run, right? When an outfielder
who sees that as a hitter, you make contact and you're on your way around the base.
Well, not in today's game, Frank. They watch everything. They watch the 348 footers.
Now you're talking about getting flipped. You might get flipped. Can you imagine? Can you imagine digging a firm spot in the batting in the batter's box, or watching if you click him? Watching? Can you imagine Bobby Gibson? Ooh!
So here's
he might put a part in your hair, Chris.
Did you ever hit a baseball out of a stadium?
Tiger Stadium in left field.
You did.
Yeah.
So you could say you're one of those guys who actually hit a baseball out of the building they built.
I think Killebrew, I think Cecil Fielder, I think Mark McGuire, they did it. There have been a lot of great, great strokes from the left side. Mm-hmm. Usually your picture-perfect swings come from left-handed. Williams, Freddie Lynn, Willie McCovey, Willie Stargell. Most of them are left-hand hitters. I thought the right-hand hitters that mechanically had great swings, I thought Roy Sievers, I thought Mark McGuire, I thought Dick Stewart. I thought Dick Stewart had one of the really great swings from the right side. And talking about a guy who hit a baseball a long way.
So why are lefties prettier? Why is that?
I don't know. Boy, I thought Freddie Lynn. How big was Freddie Lynn?
6'2", maybe?
6'2".
Maybe?
But he probably didn't weigh more than, 190 pounds at most?
All right, let's see what it lists him as. They have Fred Lynn listed at 6'1", 180 pounds.
Well, I was going to say, I think he's a little taller. I think he's about 6'2".
Okay.
Boy, we played in an old-timers game. I thought, man alive, no effort in his swing. Great bat speed generated from a very smooth setup. So load up, very fluid getting back to it. How can a guy this size hit a baseball that far? I mean, it's all timing, hand-eye coordination, bat speed. Well, I thought, man, this guy got one of the great swings. Mark Grace had a great swing, I thought. Palmeiro had a great swing. These are guys that I saw coach him.
You seem to have a great respect for the game. So if I ask you, and by the way, drop humility for a second. How would you describe your career? Because you got 1,700 hits. You almost hit 400 home runs. And I know you sort of shake it off a little bit. You were honest. You said maybe you should have worked at it a little bit harder. But how do you look back at your career?
Like I said earlier, it's been a roller coaster ride, Chris. A lot of ups, a lot of downs. I've been in those 2-for-22s most of my life. I've also been on a couple little tears. But it's been, you know what? Now, this is America. We play to win.
Yeah.
Play to lose. We play to win.
Can I tell you what I think has happened with your career? And maybe
enjoy it. And I have enjoyed it. I've enjoyed the men that I've played
right.
with. I've enjoyed the men that I've played. I've competed against the world's greatest players.
Mm-hmm.
And I've played with some of the world's greatest players. It's been a thrill.
I think your career, though, has gained sort of maybe it was when baseball came back to Washington. Maybe there were some things. I really think that your career, and again, this is you're too humble to say, but I think people sort of reassessed a little bit of your career. I do. I think there's a great respect for what it is you were able. And by the way, you certainly could have played in the NBA. You certainly could have been a basketball player.
Well, I could have maybe in the late 50s, but I don't know about today. I might make a team today in the NBA, but I won't get in too many games.
So why did you choose baseball then?
I always liked it, playing it. I like playing baseball better than basketball.
Which one were you better at?
Well, at that time in my life, in the late 50s, I'd play a better basketball player than I was a baseball player. But there again, getting back to those 4 years I spent in winter ball, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico. Well, you know what? I have a lot of friends, and a lot of them are gone now, too. Vic Power, my manager. Felix Mantilla, Jose Pagan, Felix Torres, got the Alouz, Juan Morichal. I have a lot of friends in Latin America. And I told them, I said, you know what, for me, I'm going to be very kind to myself and say I was young and naive. I was just young and dumb. But for me, those 4 years, I learned to speak a secondary language, saw a different culture, experienced a different diet, and I got paid for it.
Right.
Now, not the kind of money they're getting today, but it was pretty good money in those days. It was like a college education.
Thank you. I'm glad you said it that way, because that's the other part of what I think has happened. And I'll be honest with you. I've been having conversations with baseball players for over 20 years. I've spoken to guys who played in the 1930s, Ernie Coy, Eldon Auker, guys who played, Virgil Trucks, who played in the 40s into the 50s. This is my assessment. This is me. I've gotten to know a lot of today's players. I've become friendly with a lot of players by covering the game the way that I have. But I don't know if they've led a life that 30 years from now, it'll be overly interesting to talk to them. And it's not a knock, but I think whether it's gated communities, whether it's multi-year contracts, whether it's sort of playing a little bit with your head down, not doing 4 years in the Dominican or Cuba or Puerto Rico, and not having the 24 minor league teams where somebody's looking to get your job every year because you're on a one-year contract. This is not disparaging, but I don't think they're going to be as interesting to speak to as guys who played in your era, the era before, maybe even into the 70s and 80s. I don't think they've lived the life. I really don't, Frank. I'm not sure if they've lived the same life.
Well, Henry Aaron, Wade Boggs, Don Mattingly, Willie Mays, Reggie Jackson, they all played winter ball. If it's good enough for them, it certainly should be good enough for us.
For everybody. Well, listen.
You got it.
All right, Frank, I really, really appreciated this. As I said, your career as a coach, we didn't even talk about it, but congratulations for wanting to give back to the game, too.
I'm going to give you a little advice here now from an economic standpoint.
Sure.
You hit him on the barrel of the bat, you're going to make a ton of money. You hit him down there on the handle where I used to hit too many of them, you'll get released. So don't hit him off the handle. Hit him off the end of the bat.
Let's barrel him up. Frank, listen,
all
you're
right,
a treasure.
Yeah,
thank you very much. Have a really good day, Frank. Thank you.
Listen, I'm going to tell you, D.C. is a fantastic city. You great fans are appreciated by the Nationals organization. In economics. 24 is the professional's professional. He's the pro's pro. He's in the Hall of Fame for one reason. It's like having outstanding equipment. He's got a great baseball mind. Big Yankee heart. Fire in his belly every time he went to the mound. That kind of talent comes along. And that's the reason why they're in the Hall of Fame. That kind of talent comes along every 25, 30 years. I've seen guys in a ball game scull two or three balls in a ball game. I never saw five balls in one game. It's so hard in my life. About 2,200 feet, about 500, 500, that's 1,000. 437, that's 1,500. 295, that's 700. About 2,200 feet. This is every. Knows the game of baseball from A to Z. Probably the most fundamentally sound, or as fundamentally a sound manager and player has ever played in the big league. The epitome of presence, class, charisma. He walk into a room, the room would light up. Very, very dapper man.
Do you believe he belongs in the Hall of Fame, Bill?
In my own mind, that's up to the writers, but in my own personal mind, I'm a little biased. I didn't see Mantle in the prime of his career. Best 5-tool player I've ever seen by me. Best hitter I've ever seen is Henry Aaron. Where's that bat? We got a bat out there. But anyways, the best hitter I've ever seen. Leads the National League in hitting twice before he's 25 years old. Milwaukee Braves. Crosswinds. Hit 25. 1 year he hit 40 there, but he hit 25. Leads the league and hitting twice, goes to Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, prevailing winds blowing the left field, opened up, got up on the plate, opened up a little bit, throw him three fastballs down the way, get that much to the plate, he's liable to walk back to the dugout, but you better hadn't thrown that fastball three quarters to play in. It's going to go off that wall into the seats. So we go up to play the Braves in West Palm Beach spring training. Ain't not going to play that day. We parked our bus in the back of the right field fence there at the old West Palm Stadium. And he's hitting on the back field. So anyway, I watched this guy hit, never trying to hit the ball the ballpark. Everything, he must hit 50 line drives on the outfield grass between the third baseman and the shortstop on the outfield grass. Somebody said, Hank, you can't go to right field anymore. Backed off the plate a little bit, got his hands up, hit about five more line drives over the second baseman's head. So he comes over the field as a hammer. I said, I looked at his bat. Everything's right on that sweet part of that bat. Then I looked at mine. I got ball marks on the hand, on the handle. The sweet part of the bat's virgin territory. But anyway, I said, hammer. I said, how many, most guys break 10, 15 bats a year. How many bats you break a year? He looked up at me, he's a big Frank. I don't break bats, I wear them out.
26, and again, he gets a standing ovation. And the cheers for Hondo, who waved his batting helmet to the fans. The owners of the American League could see this. The ones who voted 10-2 to move this club out of Washington. He comes out again. Hondo threw his helmet into the stands, a souvenir of the big guy.